your monthly error, is the money you have saved this month. When your monthly error is consistently zero, you will know you have mastered step two, keeping track of every penny. Congratulations, you have achieved a minor miracle. Figure 3.2 in your PDF shows a sample set of monthly figures, but please use it only as a model. The fun and empowerment comes from creating a balance system that works for your particular situation. Making money real. Now comes one of the magic keys to this program. What you have in front of you, as accurate and balanced as it may be, does not yet have the power to transform your relationship with money. This is simply a byproduct of a month of successfully tracking little pieces of paper and bits of metal. You may have had emotional reactions to this accounting, but they will be forgotten as soon as you embark on your next trip to the Gazinga Spin store. The fact that you may spend, let's say, 80 pieces of paper, dollars, on magazines a month does not have any direct relevance to your experience of life. However, remembering that money is something you trade your life energy for, you can now translate that $80 into something that is real for you, your life energy. Use the following formula. Money spent on magazines over real hourly wage equals hours of life energy. In Chapter 2, we did a sample calculation that showed how a theoretical $25 an hour salary could end up being, in reality, $10 an hour. Obviously, your real hourly wage will end up being a different figure, but for the sake of this example, let's use $10 an hour. So, in this case of this magazine habit, you can divide that $80 by your real hourly wage, $10, and find that you have spent 8 hours of your life for this particular pleasure. $80 over $10 equals 8 hours of life energy. Now you can measure your growing pile of all that wonderful yet unread magazines on your bedside table against something real. 8 unredeemable hours of your one-way journey from cradle to grave. That's a whole day of work. Those magazines drain your energy 3 times over, once in earning the money to buy them, again in staying up late to read them, and finally in feeling guilty when you haven't finished them by the time the next issue arrives, to say nothing of having to store or dispose of them. Could those 8 hours have been better spent? How about taking Friday off? Is it still true that you have no time to spend with your family? What does this do to your habitual procrastination? You've been wanting to catch up on your sleep. Did you just find a way to do that? Or were those magazines worth every hour spent to acquire them? Did they give you 8 hours of pleasure or valuable education, and then some? Don't answer these questions yet. Just notice that translating dollars into hours of your life reveals the real trade-offs you are making for your style of living. In Chapter 4, we'll analyze those findings further. Let's look at another example, your rent or mortgage payment. Let's say you pay $1,500 a month for the privilege of living in your house or apartment. Applying the awareness that your real hourly wage is $10, divide that $1,500 by 10. Here is the reality. It costs you 150 hours a month to put this particular roof over your head. If you're putting in the standard 40-hour work week, you'll soon realize that your housing cost eats up almost every hour you put in on the job. Every working hour is going to pay for a house that you will get to enjoy perhaps 2 or 3 hours a day. Is it worth it? Sure, you can shave off some hours to account for your mortgage deduction or the benefit of your mother-in-law rental, but excuses like, "I live in an expensive city," let you off the hook too easily. Be grateful for the starkness of this awareness. It will do wonders for your personal bottom line. No shame, No blame, but no wheedling and whining either. Now take the total of each row in your monthly tabulation and convert the dollars spent in each subcategory into hours of life energy spent, and you may round off to the nearest half hour. Your monthly tabulation form will now have the total hours of life energy column, as seen in figure 3.1 in your PDF. Some pictures are worth a thousand words. Let's look at a real-life example of how some FIers put this step to work for themselves. Take a look at how Rosemary I set up her categories in figure 3.3 in your PDF. Don't you feel as if you know a little bit about her unique personality just from looking at her tabulation for January? She obviously puts a high value on beauty, since she has two categories that refer to it, beauty and aesthetics. She obviously takes care of her body and is willing to spend money on maintaining her health. It is telling that she has wellness categories like health products and health services, rather than sickness categories like drugs and doctors. The donations category says she contributes to causes enough to have a separate category, rather than lumping donations under miscellaneous. The personal growth category is one you wouldn't find in a standard budget book. This is awareness as opposed to strict budgeting. The very process of creating this form provided Rosemary with valuable information about her priorities and gave her a tangible way to track how much of her life energy she was devoting to the things that matter to her. The monthly ritual of filling in the numbers has the quality of an exciting game. How did she do in each category? Is it up or down from last month? How does it compare to last year's average for the same category? Are trends up or down? Now let's look at how one couple has gone about creating categories and a monthly tabulation form for tracking them. Maddie and Tom C. live in rural Maine. Professionally, they are quite different. He drives a truck and she's an accountant. Personally, though, they are best buddies and are enjoying the awareness and communication that comes from combining their income and expenses. When they computed their real hourly wage, they combined their totals to come out with a single figure for the two of them, $10.23 an hour. As you can see in figure 3.4 in your PDF, Maddie's total adjusted hours were 77.5 and Tom's were 67.5, or 145 hours combined. Maddie's total income was $1,080.31, and Tom's was $402.50, making the grand total of $1,482.81. Dividing combined income by combined hours is how they established that figure of $10.23 an hour. Dividing 60 minutes by that real hourly wage tells us that every dollar spent represented nearly 6 minutes of life energy. Combining their total income and expenses works for Maddie and Tom. Other couples have found that separating their income and expenses was the only way to get an accurate reflection of their unique patterns. You think because Mary and Don M. shared the same passion, music, and the same profession, computer programming, it would be natural for them to track their income and expenses together. But while they were outwardly a matched pair, their personalities and styles were opposite ends of the spectrum. Don was near the rational, conservative, and deliberate end. Mary was more toward the emotional, experimental, and disorganized end. Their Gazinga spins were different. Their shopping habits were different. Their hobbies, beside music, were different. Doing their monthly tabulations together wasn't giving either of them much good information. Not only that, but soon after starting the program, Mary left her programming job and started teaching piano full-time out of their home. Her hours and pay became irregular, so they decided that she would offset her smaller contribution to the household kitty by donating the housekeeping chores. This non-monetary arrangement didn't show up to their satisfaction in the monthly tabulations. The more they struggled to make it work, the more tension arose. In order to maintain a friendly marriage and stay on the program, they decided to separate their finances. To Don, it was sensible. To Mary, it was threatening, but she agreed to give it a try. To her amazement, Mary found that having her own accounts gave her a wonderful feeling of autonomy. She discovered that she'd become dependent in many subtle ways during the years of her marriage, and she reconnected with the strength and independence she'd felt when she was single. Now let's look at how another FIer did her end-of-the-month balance sheet. Elaine H. from Chapter 1 applied her computer programmer's logical mind to the task of setting up a balance sheet for herself. Her monthly tabulation categories were enough like Rosemary's that we don't need to reproduce them, but her balance sheet has a precision and elegance that are instructive. See Figure 3.5 in your PDF. Setting up this form for herself made the end-of-the-month balancing process easy and accurate. Her capital is the combination of what she has in savings, a money market account, and bonds. This is all money that is earning interest, which she likes to keep separate from the money in her checking account. During the month of August, her net worth increased by nearly $6,000, and she missed track $15.40. The point of these stories is not to provide you with a standard to follow, but inspire you to create a monthly tabulation form that works for you. Remember, this is not a budget book or a spending plan. This is not trying to fit your square or octagonal peg into society's round hole. Creating your form will be a process of self-discovery. You aren't learning the right way. You are creating your own way. There is no right way to do it, other than to do it. This step is crucial to the whole rest of the program, which is why those people who proudly report that they are on the program but are guesstimating rather than tracking are off base. This step provides insight and empowerment and will be worth every minute you invest in setting it up to work for you. Summary of Step 3. 1. Discern your unique spending and income categories and subcategories from your month of tracking income and expenses. 2. Set up your monthly tabulation. 3. Enter all money transactions in the appropriate category. 4. Total your money spent in each subcategory. 5. Add up total monthly income and total monthly expenses. Total your cash on hand and balance all bank accounts. Apply equation total monthly income minus total monthly expenses plus or minus monthly error. The money you actually have at the end of the month should equal what you had at the beginning plus your monthly income minus your monthly expenses. 6. Convert the dollars spent in each category into hours of life energy, using the real hourly wage that you computed in Step 2. Money Talk Questions. 2, 3, 4, or more minds are better than one. Sometimes seeing how others do the steps helps, and just the tangible work will raise so many interesting questions. Using the suggestions in the epilogue for how to have a money talk, raise the following questions in your daily reflections, with your partner, or in social groups. Remember, adding why to the end of any question will take it deeper. Adding how has society shaped my answer to any question will take it wider. There are no right answers. How do you stay conscious with your money? What do you insure and why? What question would you most like to ask a friend about money? An expert? A relative? How do you feel when you spend money? What are some of your best experiences with tipping, tithing, or giving? What are your top priorities and how does your spending support them or not? Chapter 4. How Much is Enough? The Quest for Happiness. In saving my life, she conferred a value on it. It is a currency I do not know how to spend. Sherlock TV series. What will you do with your one wild and precious life? Mary Oliver, poet. Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and then do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Howard Thurman, philosopher and theologian. What makes you come alive? What will you do with this life you have been given? Ashley Brilliant, the master of under-17 word quip, once drew a cartoon of a forlorn boy saying, "I don't know how to be happy. They didn't teach it in school." If the pursuit of happiness is our birthright, written into the Declaration of Independence, and yet our aptitude for happiness was all but squeezed out of us in school, we need to look now at what fills us with happiness or fulfillment. Fulfillment is our compass and our rudder for transforming our relationship with money. Whether in the sense of accomplishing a goal or letting go into a moment of real contentment, fulfillment is that experience of deep satisfaction when you can say, "Ah, that was a delicious meal, a job well done, a purchase worth the money." You have an aspiration or an expectation, and you recognize and celebrate that the very thing you wanted has arrived. To find such fulfillment and be mindful of it, then, you need to know what you are looking for. It's fairly easy to know what fulfillment is in terms of food or other temporary pleasures, but to have fulfillment in the larger sense, to have a fulfilled life, you need to have a sense of purpose, a dream of what a good life might be. For many of us, however, growing up has meant outgrowing our dreams or having them shrink in the face of harsh circumstances or people. Debt for many has been the great dream destroyer, acquired to fund a dream of an education or a home or a wedding, and then standing by the door of every future dream, arms crossed, saying, "Pay up or you can't go further." Some of us just accept debt as a part of adult life and trot on, shackled by consequences we don't fully understand. Whether to the debt collectors, your bills, hard luck, poor choices, or your own insecurities, if you have sacrificed your dreams on the altar of the almighty dollar, you need to reclaim them as they are your fuel for this journey. Did you dream of writing a great book, but now write marketing copy for money? That book is still there. Did you dream of being a healer but now work for an HMO with back-to-back 15-minute appointments? That dream of selfless service is still in there. It might take a radical change to reclaim it, but it's not gone. Were you inspired by your faith to inspire others in their search for God, but now spend most of your time in congregation politics and fundraising? That dream is not gone, just deferred. Between the life you dreamed of and the life you have, what happened? And has it diminished your courage to dream big again? Has the constant buzz of daily tasks slowly narrowed your vision to the plodding step ahead? Have you been told, "Don't worry, those dreams will go away in time," as if dreams themselves are childish affairs? Do we really need to just grow up? We cannot let our lives be dreams deferred, as Langston Hughes wrote in his famous poem, Harlem. It's time to let your dreams speak, even as you still have to put food on the table and pay off debts. Dreaming once again does not mean absolving ourselves of financial responsibilities. It means reviving our dreams as juice for the journey. Wherever you are, take a few moments now to reflect upon your dreams. Can you remember what you wanted before you were told to grow up and fit your round peg in a square cubicle? Use these questions to trigger memories and stimulate thoughts. What did you want to be when you grew up? What have you always wanted to do that you haven't done yet? What have you done in your life that you are really proud of? If you knew you were going to die within a year, how would you spend that year? What brings you the most fulfillment, and how is that related to money? If you didn't have to work for a living, what would you do with your time? These are potent questions. You may have looked at some before, but without a bridge between your present reality and your aspirations. This program is your bridge, so no dream is too large. Take your time. Use your journal. Dig. Keep asking the same question until you run out of answers before going on to the next one. Talk to your friends. Invite them to dig with you. Revisit your answers frequently to see what has changed. A few years after graduating from college, Grant Sabatier had his wake-up call when he discovered he hadn't enough money to buy a burrito. He was living with his parents, a classic failure to launch Millennial. That was when he decided he was going to make $1 million by age 30. He said the first thing he needed to do was change his mindset to one of saving, which he refers to as pay yourself first. He took a screenshot of his measly bank account, set the goal of having $1 million in assets in 5 years, and immediately started educating himself. He's now a successful blogger, Millennial Money, and a digital strategist who offers 6 steps to wealth, which includes side jobs, stock market investments, lifestyle changes, and daily saving goals. He hit his goal, took another screenshot when his total assets passed $1 million, and then realized his dreams were far bigger than $1 million, as motivating as that number had been. As a graduate in philosophy from the University of Chicago, he knows that life is about asking big questions. What is empathy, fulfillment, happiness, peace? He sees his FI as a chance to think, write, and speak about these fundamental questions and go where his answers take him. Amy and Jim D., inspirations for an earlier generation's shift to thrift through their financial magazine, the Tightwad Gazette, had a simple dream. They wanted to raise a family in a big farmhouse in a rural area. When they got married, they had, between the two of them, logged more than 20 years in the workaday world. Jim is a career Navy man, and Amy is a graphic artist. Yet they had only $1,500 in savings to show for it. They recognized that they valued family and community above the fast lane of life in which they had both been living, and they decided to raise their children and realize their dream on only one income, Jim's salary from the Navy. To realize their dream, they called upon the frugality training they'd gotten from their thrifty parents and devised scads of new strategies for saving money. Neither had any sense of deprivation. They thrived on this challenge to their creativity, and their relationship thrived on their shared purpose. In 7 years, they had 4 children and saved enough to make a down payment on a rural farmhouse in Maine, pay off all debts, and buy a new car, furniture, and appliances. 2 years after that, Amy decided to put her graphic skills to work and create a forum where frugal ideas could be exchanged. In June 1990, she published the premier issue of the Tightwad Gazette, an 8-page newsletter full of practical tips about living the good life on a shoestring. A year later, they had twins and were still able to live within their means. Their story is testimony to the fact that common dreams, like having a house in the country and staying home to raise a family, are truly within reach. Wes L.'s passion is nature, both being in it and preserving it. For him, the FI program is a way to do what he always wanted to do, contribute to humanity's understanding of and respect for the natural world, and do it full time. He's aligning as many parts of his life as possible with his dream. His paid employment is as a chemist measuring air quality. He's moved within walking distance of work, so he won't contribute as much to the air pollution he's measuring. On vacations, he kayaks through unspoiled wilderness areas. And on weekends, he teaches kayaking to help others experience nature safely and respectfully. With his quote-unquote disposable income, he builds up his savings and supports major conservation organizations. The compass of his life is the natural world, and every aspect of his life points in that direction. Kathy and Langdon L. had dreams not just for themselves, but for making the world a better place, as corny as they knew that sounded. Langdon was a physician and the medical director of a migrant worker clinic. Kathy was a former teacher active in the programs of a number of nonprofit organizations, who also held down the fort for her family. They loved their lives, but looked forward to an empty nest so that they too could fly the coop. The financial program gave them a way to retire from their paid employment at the same time they retired from being full-time parents. They moved to a small town and bought land that became the heart of an eco-village, an intentional community committed to sustainability on every level possible. At first, it was a village of two, but over time, others joined in, building their own small and unique houses and building a rich communal life together. At one point, the outgoing, energetic Langdon became the mayor of the town, while Kathy was drawn to her painting studio. What dreams are calling you? Step 4 of this financial program is your chance to make your dreams come true by aligning your earning and spending with your values, aspirations, purpose, and happiness. It will turn making a dying into making a living. Step 4, 3 questions that will transform your life. In this step, you evaluate your spending by asking 3 questions about the total money spent in each of your subcategories. 1. Did I receive fulfillment, satisfaction, and value in proportion to the life energy I spent? 2. Is this expenditure of life energy in alignment with my values and life purpose? 3. How might this expenditure change if I didn't have to work for money? Each of these questions points to a facet of your dreams. The first asks if your spending is bringing you the kind of happiness you feel when you are living your dream. The second asks if this spending is taking you in the direction of your dreams. The third asks you to imagine how this spending would change if you no longer had to make money to support your lifestyle. To do this step, go back to your monthly tabulation form, see figure 3.1 in your PDF, and notice the 3 blank columns you should have included next to your expenses. This is where you will write the answers to our 3 questions. You've already converted dollars into hours of life energy. Now you can take a look at how you want to spend that precious commodity. These 3 questions, applied to each spending subcategory on your monthly tabulation, will give you a basis for evaluating the way you spend your money. Question 1. Did I receive fulfillment, satisfaction, and value in proportion to the life energy spent? This question provides a way to evaluate your expenditures. Take a look at each subcategory with this question in mind. If you received so much fulfillment from this expenditure of life energy that you even would like to increase spending in this subcategory, place a plus or an up arrow in the first box. If you received little or no fulfillment from it, put a minus or a down arrow in that box. If the expense feels okay just as it is, mark that box with a 0. This simple exercise will show you where your spending is so automatic or even addictive that your life energy flows in that direction while fulfillment lies in the opposite. You might even find your shopping weaknesses, your gazinga spins. At first, you might angrily defend one or another of your Gazinga spin habits. I like having lots of shoes. Every pair has a function. Anyway, it's my money. Or, I like having books. So what if I stop at the bookstore every day on the way home? And so what if I don't read them? Someday, I'm sure I will. Or, I like quilting, and so what if I collect fabric for my quilting projects, even if I'm not making a quilt now? Okay, I haven't made one in a decade, but you can never have enough variety of fabric. Or, so what if I have dot, dot, dot? And on, we defend our Gazinga's pin buying habit. But no one is trying to take your Gazinga's pins away from you. In fact, no one is even listening, since the honesty required by this exercise emerges most readily in solitude. Over time, seeing the number of hours of your life you spend in order to reward yourself with yet another Gazinga's pin might make it a little bit less of a treasure and more of a booby prize. On the other hand, you might find you've been too much of a penny pincher in categories in which you get a lot of fulfillment. Make sure you note these areas of supreme satisfaction and put your plus or up arrow in the columns in which you are actually underspending. The trick for doing this evaluation is to do it objectively without rationalizing to yourself why the expenditure was so high or low and without condemning yourself by agonizing about how you spent so much in this category. The key phrase to remember is, no shame, no blame. Couples have also found this step a valuable way to discuss differences in their spending habits with equanimity and objectivity. Martha and Ted P. discovered that this question provided a gentle way to evaluate each other's spending patterns without getting defensive or adversarial. Rather than challenging one of Ted's purchases, Martha can just calmly ask whether he really got fulfillment, satisfaction, and value in proportion to the amount of life energy spent. They find they are able to observe and even comment on each other's Gazinga's pins with a lot more compassion. Being able to discuss financial choices without subtle bickering has been invaluable for them and has actually helped their marriage. Cheap thrills and deep thrills. A grandfather with a love for simple living had tried to instill his values in his young grandson. One day the boy excitedly announced a brand new discovery. "Grandpa, Grandpa, I know what happiness is." "What?" the old man asked, sure he would hear a gem worth sharing. "It's that feeling you get right after you buy something." Cheap thrills are like that little feeling you get when you buy something. It's the ka-ching of the pinball machine. The happiness rarely lasts. It has a half-life of the distance from cash register to car. Deeper thrills come when you've achieved a dream bigger than your ego's aspirations. "This is the true joy in life," George Bernard Shaw wrote in his preface to Man and Superman. The being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. The being thoroughly worn out before you are thrown on the scrap heap. The being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world would not devote itself to making you happy. Cheap thrills come from external rewards. Deep thrills come from being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. Cheap thrills are passing. Deep thrills are lasting. Your internal yardstick for fulfillment measures deep thrills. Developing an internal yardstick for fulfillment. The primary tool for developing this internal yardstick is awareness. Answering question one helps you develop an internal yardstick for fulfillment and kick any unhealthy spending habits in the process. Most of us use external yardsticks for fulfillment. In fact, Ashley Brilliant, they did teach that in school. We measure our fulfillment by pleasing others, getting an A, proving ourselves to the bully from third grade who still lives in our minds, beating out the competition, making it onto whatever top 10 list you worship, winning, not winning but getting a trophy anyway, scoring big in romance or sales records. These are external yardsticks for fulfillment. You look elsewhere to see how you're doing. The gleam in your mother's or partner's eye, the tally of votes, the bestseller list. This feeling, though, isn't true fulfillment. There is a difference between the jolt of energy you get from a temporary win and the long-term satisfaction you get from achieving a dream. Guaranteed, if you think your dream is getting an A on a test or beating your opponent, you will chase after external rewards your whole life. Enough. The deepest thrill. The affluence that surrounds us has been called the American dream, and with good reason. We've been asleep. We wake up by questioning the dream, asking yourself month in, month out, whether you actually got fulfillment in proportion to life energy spent in each subcategory awakens that natural sense of knowing when enough is enough. You come to differentiate between a passing fancy and real fulfillment. Recall the fulfillment curve from Chapter 1, that point of enoughness where desires disappear because they have been completely met. Any less would not be enough. Any more would be too much. A fulfilling meal is one in which all the flavors, smells, and textures blend perfectly and your appetite is satisfied without even a trace of the discomfort of having overeaten. In the same way, a fulfilling car is one that meets your transportation needs perfectly, is pleasing enough to the eye that you will enjoy owning it for many, many thousands of miles, that doesn't insult your wallet or your values, and that, with good maintenance, will be both reliable and a pleasure to drive. Unless, of course, buying and driving a classic 1957 big tail fin gas-guzzling convertible has been your lifelong dream, then it's worth every hour you'll have to work for it. Your internal yardstick dismisses superficial desires to impress others or relieve the boredom as good reasons to upgrade your ride or tack 3 more years of work onto your making a dying work life. One test of whether you're using an internal rather than external yardstick is this. The purchase or experience leaves you satisfied, content, at peace. You stop craving the very thing you just consumed because you've actually scratched the right itch in the right way. Financial integrity. Having an internal yardstick for fulfillment is actually one part of what we call financial integrity. You learn to make your financial choices independent of what advertising and industry have decided would be good for their business. You are free of the humiliation of being manipulated into spending your life energy on things that don't bring you happiness. Nina N., whose story we'll be hearing in Chapter 7, reported that before doing this evaluation, she felt powerless over the money in her wallet. I'd walk into a store and my money would like fly out of my wallet. Not literally, but that's how it felt. I couldn't stop it. It's a form of financial independence to be able to just say no to unconscious spending. By putting your up and down arrows and zeros in, month out, perhaps just from a gut sense, perhaps from careful, conscious thought, you will build this financial muscle of stopping it enough. Sometimes you'll see old habits creeping back in, get angry with yourself and want to quit. That's when no shame, no blame comes in handy. Question 2. Is this expenditure of life energy in alignment with my values and life purpose? This question is illuminating. It gives you a concrete way of looking at whether you're practicing what you preach. As you did with the first question, ask of each spending category, was this expenditure of life energy in alignment with my values and life purpose? If your answer is a strong yes, put a plus or an up arrow in the second box in that row. If it's a no, just put a negative or down arrow. If it's fine just as it is, put a zero. People like Amy and Jim D had a clear set of values and a strong sense of purpose when they undertook their tightwad campaign. So did Wes L. and Kathy and Langdon L. Measuring their financial choices against question two helped them to align their finances with their dreams. On the other hand, many people living otherwise well-off lives are suffering from a poverty of ideals. Many heirs and heiresses are among the lost and confused, all dressed up financially and nowhere to go. And lots of ordinary people who've achieved the American dream are also wondering whether there isn't more to life than this. What about you? Are your values and life purpose clear? Or are they out of focus, buried under the weight of a lifestyle that doesn't seem to fit? Part 1. What are our values? Our values are those principles and qualities that matter to us. Truth is a principle, and honesty is a quality of how we live truth. Living our values gives us peace of mind. Not doing so disturbs our conscience, and if we aren't aware of what's going on, disables that inner gyroscope that orients us. Values are like an ethical DNA, made up of our sense of right and wrong that structures our choices. So our values reflect our beliefs. But since how we act reflects our real motivations, our values are revealed by our behaviors. Parents sometimes try to sidestep this fact with the phrase, "Do as I say, not as I do." When we choose to provide food, shelter, and clothing for our children, we are making that choice on the basis of values. Being a good parent, expressing a natural feeling of love. When we spend our day off walking in the park or going back to the office, our choice is based on values. "But I had to go to the office," you say. That's not a values decision. That's a pure necessity. Yet you value the paycheck, so you choose to do the job, or you value being responsible to your family, or you value the good opinion of your boss. Our behavior is a concrete representation of our values. How we spend our time and money speaks volumes about who we are and what we stand for. This audio deals with one of the chief social manifestations of our values, how we handle money in our lives. Looking at your monthly tabulations, what does $250 or 25 hours of life energy at the $10 per hour we calculated in our example in Chapter 2, spent on eating out, reveal in terms of values? It could indicate any number of things: that you value convenience, that you like good food, or that you want social time with friends. What about the 12 hours donated to charity, the 15 hours for your cell phone bill? You might find that you are comfortable with many of these expenditures, and some you may question. 25 hours of life energy spent on eating out may seem fine, until you realize upon reflection that you devoted only 8 hours this month to one of your children, or that those hours spent eating out dwarf what you spent on concerts and museums, though you claim that you get your life's pleasure from the arts. For many people, the values expressed in their expenditures are not the values they really want to be living. Your totals in some of your categories may reveal that habit, peer pressure, or even boredom has gotten the best of you. Go back to the questions at the beginning of the chapter. If you didn't have to work for a living, what would you do with your time? What have you done with your life that you are really proud of? How would you spend the next year if you knew it was the last year of your life? Your answer to these questions will tell you a lot about what you truly value. Your monthly tabulations are like a mirror. As you ask the question, "Is this expenditure in alignment with my values?" month in and month out, you will find that you're looking ever more deeply into yourself. Simply as a result of asking and answering this question, you will make changes, large and small, that bring you closer to financial integrity. in which all aspects of your financial life are in harmony with your true values. Samuel D. had the traditional makings of a very nice life, but was angry and frustrated with a system that had led him to believe that if he had the right stuff, house, cars, job, he'd feel fulfilled. He didn't. As he did his monthly evaluation, the problem became clear. He realized that his predominant desire was to contribute something towards solving some of the world's problems, instead of just being one of the decent yet sleeping millions. He took a risk and a cut in pay by leaving the school system to develop a private counseling firm. Eventually, he went into partnership with an associate, holding training sessions and seminars to help people get in touch with their true values and worth, and with their responsibility to themselves and the larger community. His insides now match his outside, and he's finally happy. Part 2. What is purpose? The second part of this question calls on you to evaluate your expenditures in light of your life purpose. Purpose is the overarching goal that embodies our values and dreams. But what does that really mean? Purpose implies direction and time. You do something now to have something later that you value. It's a concerted intention to do something meaningfully, both for yourself and the world at large. For some people like Amy and Jim D, doing work they enjoy and raising a loving family defines their purpose. For others, the sense of purpose might be elusive, not quite in focus. Their actions don't reflect their deepest desires. Some individuals, waking up to the emptiness of a purposeless life, spend years looking for some purpose to give their life meaning. Others, like Wes L., seem to have identified it from the moment of birth. What is this thing called purpose in life? Purpose can be as straightforward as your goal, I am doing this in order to get that. It can be revealed in the answer you give when someone asks, why are you doing what you are doing, your motivation? It can be the deeper meaning you ascribe to the events of your life. The real purpose of my job was to meet my wife. Life purpose, however, implies something beyond reason. It isn't simply achieving a goal or acquiring some longed-for possession. It is a chosen dedication of your life energy to something you believe is more important than your individual little existence. It is your commitment. It becomes your identity as surely as your name, your body, or your story to date, and can become more important than life itself. You can see these different kinds of purpose, goal, meaning, and dedication in this story about three stonecutters, each chipping away at a large block. A passerby approaches the first stonecutter and asks, excuse me, what are you doing? The stonecutter replies rather gruffly, can't you see? I'm chipping away at a big hunk of stone. Approaching the second craftsman, our curious person asks the same question. This stonecutter looks up with a mixture of pride and resignation and says, why, I'm earning a living to take care of my wife and children. Moving to the third worker, our questioner asks, and what are you doing? The third stonecutter looks up, his face shining, and says with reverence, I'm building a cathedral, dedication to a higher purpose. How do we find our purpose? Joanna Macy, an educator, ecologist, and author, has suggested three directions in which to look for your own purpose. 1. Work with your passion on projects you care deeply about. What was your dream before you stopped dreaming? What's the work you would do even if you weren't paid for it? You're not looking for those superficial preferences depicted on bumper stickers like, I'd rather be surfing. You're looking for something you'd give your life to, not something you use to get away from your life. 2. Work with your pain, with people whose pain touches your heart. Have you been there so you know how it feels, in grief or sorrow or despair, hunger, terror? Can you offer others the wisdom and compassion you gained from these experiences? Is there an aspect of suffering in the world that calls you to action? If you are in such pain that you've lost touch with your ability to help others, then now is the perfect time to extend your hand to others in pain. It's healing. 3. Work with what's at hand, with the opportunities that arise daily for responding to the simple needs of others. Finding your purpose has often been equated with discovering the perfect job or service project that will galvanize you to be as saintly as Mother Teresa. This suggestion to work with what's at hand is a reminder that in an interconnected world, all acts of service contribute to the good of the whole. If you remember that there is no single act of greatness, just a series of small acts done with great passion or great love, then in doing what you see needs to be done, taking dinner to a sick neighbor, helping a child learn to read, writing a letter to the editor of your newspaper, being an advocate for the homeless in your city, you will discover a life filled with the experience of having a purpose worth living for. Passion, pain, what's at hand? These are the doorways to finding a purpose beyond material acquisition. Measuring our movement toward purpose. Take a few minutes right now to write down your purpose in life. It may have nothing to do with how you spend your time. It may or may not seem significant to others. It may not even be very clear to you yet. Just do the best you can. Use this stated purpose to measure your actions. If over time you see your purpose changing, well, that's fine. Simply write what life purpose now means to you, and use this new statement of purpose as your measuring stick. However you define your purpose, you'll need to find a way to measure your results, some feedback to tell you if you are on track. Often we measure how we're doing in fulfilling our purpose by material success, or by a professional or community recognition. Another way to measure whether you're living your purpose, one that goes beyond material success, rewards, and recognition, is your answer to question 2. Is this expenditure of life energy in alignment with my values and life purpose? Asking this question faithfully every month for every category will nudge you toward clarifying your values, living in alignment with your stated purpose, and further defining your true purpose in life. Your monthly tabulation maps your spending patterns onto your quest for meaning. To return to integrity, alignment of your actions with your values, you can either adjust your spending or adjust your purpose. Question 3. How might this expenditure change if I didn't have to work for money? So far, we've seen how well our purchases fulfill us and align with our values. But question 3 evaluates how much your job costs you and focuses more clearly on your life apart from work. Ask yourself, which expenses would decrease or disappear altogether if I didn't work for money? In the third column, next to your expense category, mark a minus or down arrow if you think this expense would decrease, a plus or up arrow if it would increase, or a zero if it would possibly remain unchanged. If you can come up with an estimated dollar figure, write it in a separate line on the monthly tabulation. This question opens the possibility of a lifestyle in which you don't have to report to your job week in and week out. What would your life be like if you didn't work for money 40 or more hours a week? What expenses might disappear? If you didn't have to work for money, would you buy more clothes, fewer clothes, burn more gas, less gas, sell your car entirely, move to a cheaper house farther from the center of commerce? Would you have higher or lower medical bills? Insurance costs might go up, but illness down. Would you still take weekend getaways in hotels? Would your travel expenses go up or down? Would you no longer reward your hard work with brand new Gazinga pins? What do you now spend to simply compensate for doing a job that claims the majority of your waking hours? You don't have to know precisely what you would do if you didn't have to work for money. You don't even have to want to do anything other than your job. You just need to ask the question of each category. How would expenditures in this category change if I didn't have to work for a living? Remember, no shame, no blame. You are not violating your commitment to your profession by asking that question, nor are you expressing disloyalty to your boss or dissatisfaction with your job by considering how you might spend your money if you were doing something else. If you love your job, the simple monthly exercise of asking this question will only increase your job satisfaction because you will increase your certainty that you are there by choice. By asking question 3, you may find yourself coming to a startling conclusion. If you weren't spending most of your time making money, life could be a whole lot cheaper. Because your days are consumed by your job, you need money to handle every other aspect of your life, from daycare to home repair, from entertainment to being listened to with compassion. You will discover that financial independence has this independence from needing money to meet my needs component, quite the opposite of financial independence being rich enough to pay a multitude of minions to do everything for me. Assessing the 3 questions. Now take a look at your tabulation sheet. Find all of your minus marks or down arrows. Note which subcategories didn't meet your criterion for question 1. You did not receive fulfillment in proportion to the amount of life energy spent. Which ones didn't measure up on question 2? This expenditure was not in alignment with my values and life purpose. And which ones are expenses that would change significantly if you didn't have to make a dying? Do you see any patterns? What have you learned about yourself? Don't punish yourself and resolve to do better next month. Remember, this is not a budget. Simply use this information and any insights you've gained to assist in clarifying your values and purpose. Remember, no shame, no blame. Step 4 is truly the heart of this program. Don't worry if your life purpose or your internal yardstick are not crystal clear. For some individuals, this program has been the process by which they've defined their values and purpose. Trust that asking and answering the 3 questions month by month, year by year, will clarify and deepen your understanding of fulfillment and purpose. The steps of this program work synergistically, building upon and enhancing one another. So just relax and do the steps, all of them with integrity. And remember, no shame, no blame. This is simply an information gathering process. It is the first step toward reprogramming yourself. Any unconscious, addictive patterns of spending will be exposed and identified when you bring them into the light of honest evaluation and clear numeric expression. The point is not to drive yourself to change through guilt or self-criticism. The point is to adjust your spending until you have zeros or pluses for all your categories. Here are a few reminders about working with Step 4 to maximize your benefits. Getting to enough. In Chapter 1, we talked about the fulfillment curve and that interesting place at its peak called enough. You have enough for your survival, enough for your comforts, and even some special luxuries, with no excess to burden you unnecessarily. Enough is a powerful and free place, a confident and flexible place, and it's a place that you will define for yourself numerically as you follow this program. Asking the 3 questions is the primary tool for defining experientially how much is enough for you. You will do it each month, but you may find them coming to mind with each purchase you consider making. Our own experience is that enough has 4 components, 4 common qualities. 1. Accountability. Knowing how much money is flowing into and out of your life is basic financial intelligence. Clearly, if you never know how much you have or where it's all going, you can never have enough. 2. An internal yardstick for fulfillment. As we pointed out earlier, you can never have enough if you are measuring by what others have or think. It's like trying to go up the down escalator. Other people's opinions are fickle.